I'm Scott.
And I'm Julie.
And this is the A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast. Welcome.
Yes, welcome. Mm-hmm. We are two Catholic friends who love to talk about books and movies and the one reality that we see underlying some of these things.
That's right. That's right. And this is episode number 11. And today we're going to be talking about a book called Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang.
Yes, an amazing author.
Yes, he really is, isn't he?
Yes, he's so amazing that sometimes I thought my head was going to explode when I was reading his stories. Of course, that was from the science, not from the concepts so much.
Right, right. Yeah, I recall I had a... Do you remember what a handspring... Did you ever have a handspring? It was a Palm Pilot type of thing, but it was a different company.
No.
Different company called a handspring. So,
okay.
Anyway, I had this new little gadget and I loved it. And I went to, I think it was Peanut Press, or it may have had a different name at that time.
Uh-huh.
And I found the best science fiction stories of the year, one of those collections. And
yeah.
I downloaded it into this. This had to have been in the, it was definitely the early 2000s.
Right.
And, anyway, the first story that I read on there was Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang.
And Which is an amazing story.
Yeah, it blew me away. I couldn't believe
it.
And since then, that rekindled my interest in short science fiction, which I don't think enough people pay attention to.
I agree.
Yeah, because there is some really great stuff in there.
Yeah, I have recently come to appreciate it largely thanks to podcasting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
where you get so many of these old science fiction short stories read, and that made me suddenly on my Kindle say, you know, usually I'll just get books from Gutenberg or the free books from Amazon, which tend to be the older fiction, or a few free promotional things,
mm-hmm.
because I could buy, you know, $3,000 worth of stuff on there easily. But yes, I just go for it. But But the things that I will spend the money on are the best fantasy or best science fiction or best mystery stories of the year,
mm-hmm.
because podcasts have rekindled that. But nobody can beat Ted Chiang. I actually bought the book using this as the excuse, and I think I've mentioned that before, so I'd have it on the shelf to hopefully lure my kids into reading it.
Yeah, yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And since then, I've read everything that he's written. And he's not very prolific, which is fine. Everything that he writes is award quality. In fact, he gets nominated for awards for everything that he writes. But he writes so infrequently. You know, he may write a story a year. In fact, I noticed in this book that the first story he ever published was called Tower of Babylon, which we'll get to. And then he published another one, and then he didn't publish again for like 7 years.
And, well, he must have a real job also.
He does, yeah, he does. He's a programmer, he writes technical literature. Yeah.
I figured maybe he was in science or something, because these books are definitely science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
He puts a great deal of effort into the hard science of whatever concept it is that he's working with.
Right. And that's what was so remarkable about Story of Your Life. Story of Your Life is the name of, you know, that's what the book is named after. But it's equal parts human, it's emotional, it's deeply scientific.
Mm-hmm.
One of the central parts of that story is communication with aliens, which is treated in a way that, you know, is much more realistic. You know, it's very probable that should we ever meet aliens, that it's going to be very hard to talk to them. It's not going to be some kind of a device, you know.
Of the way they think and speak and relate to reality, I guess you would say, is so alien. I've never read anything like it.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I had to skip most of the science.
Oh, did you?
Okay, first of all, I was reading this while I was on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
So I would only read about a story a day, because I was like, you know, this is much more work than most stories I read. Because for one thing, in addition to the science being deep, it is not actually the concepts, the human concepts in the stories are not easy either.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking deeply at human beings and how they relate to each other and what is their relationship with God, and the universe and that sort of thing. And you have to really invest yourself in these stories, I think. Mm-hmm. And so, yes. And so yeah. When I was reading this story, it got so, to me, the concepts got so difficult and the way they were describing to each other what they were having to do to understand it, that I finally was just like, I'm going to skim those parts because I know the human part is what I really need to get to anyway.
Right, right.
And I'll probably reread them several times and then I'll be able to delve into it a little more easily.
Yeah, and I found them both equally interesting. I mean, it was one of the first times, you know, one of the cracks people make about science fiction so often is it's not very human and there's not, you know, good stories wrapped around the science. And I think all that changed in the 80s, you know, but there was a lot of using characters just to get through the science mm-hmm. in the hard science fiction aspect. But mm-hmm. in the 80s, I think things changed where they, you know, Orson Scott Card was probably one of the authors at that time who took human stories and the science became either secondary or it had to be an integral part of the human story in order mm-hmm. for it to be a good book.
Yeah, because it could be glossed over. You didn't have to understand the science. You could take it on faith, so
right.
to speak.
Exactly.
And he doesn't do that here. In fact, I was looking at the ends again of these three stories that we read, kind of going, what is his summing up again? Because mm-hmm. the science was so much a part of it that you need to see where he brings them together. I really, if any listeners haven't tried his stories, he is extraordinary.
Yeah, and he really is extraordinary.
I came across him in podcasts, like Starship Sofa.
Oh, yeah. And there's a good interview of him on a Starship Sofa.
Oh, okay. I don't really like interviews usually, but I'll mm-hmm. have to look for that.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, and on a podcast, I think it was Podcastle. Mm-hmm. I hope I have that right, but they did Hell is the Absence of God.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's I heard that, and I keep an eye out for him. He's very generous with letting people podcast his stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where
I wish someone would do Story of Your Life, because I would love that.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Yes, I'd like to see them do the graphs.
That's right.
Well, and I heard Hell is the Absence of God on a podcast, too. Mm-hmm. I can't remember which
right,
one.
Right, that's the podcast one, I believe.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought mm-hmm. you said Tower. I was thinking Tower of Babylon.
Yeah, and Tower of Babylon. I don't know that is in audio, but could have been in the Best Fantasy 2001. I see that he's listed on there,
mm-hmm.
but I cannot find a table of contents for that audiobook. I don't have it.
Right.
But as I was just looking around, I couldn't find it.
Story somewhere else. And it could have been a collection like that.
Okay.
So then I was thinking maybe I'd heard it.
Mm-hmm.
But what was frustrating is this is not a complete collection of his stories now, because it's two or three years after the book came out.
Yeah, but he hasn't written a lot since then.
Not included in this. Machines in their universe.
Yeah, Exhalation.
Rust.
Exhalation, yeah. And that's available on audio.
Okay.
And then his newest one is called The Life Cycle of Software Objects, which I bought from Subterranean Press but have not read yet. It's sitting there on my shelf.
Man, because the description sounded, again, so interesting. I just feel like we're lucky because we're here in a time when somebody of this caliber is turning out this fiction. It's like being there when, Harlan Ellison has written a new story, mm-hmm. you know? Yep. I came across all those things after the fact.
Right, right.
So,
Yeah, and he's that remarkable to me. He's one of my absolute favorite writers.
Well, and so, what kind of makes this interesting to me is that he deals so consistently with issues of faith
mm-hmm.
and humans. And I guess we'll get into this later, but his worldview does not seem to be one that I necessarily share with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I love is that he can talk about this so well that it gives us a springboard still for our own conversations, even though his conclusions may not be the ones that we would agree with.
Right, right. How about, I found an interview on Fantastic Metropolis of Ted Chiang, in which he kind of states his view about religion.
Okay.
So I'll just go ahead and read that right now.
Okay.
The interviewer asks, when reading your stories, especially 72 Letters, Tower of Babylon, and Hell is the Absence of God, one gets a distinct cynical notion towards organized religion and God. What is your attitude towards religions? And if I may, what is your attitude toward God or the notion of God? Do you yourself believe in God? And Ted Chiang answers, I wasn't raised in any religion, so I don't have any such strong feelings toward religion that many people do. When I was younger, I had a vague belief in God, but as I grew older, it seemed to me that the idea of God didn't explain anything that couldn't be explained otherwise, so I'm currently an atheist. I think religion is interesting, but my interest is strictly abstract. I recently had a conversation with someone who said she had occasionally experienced epiphanies, moments when she felt the presence of the divine. I have never experienced anything like that, which probably keeps my interest in religion from becoming more than abstract. So, from that answer, I feel that he's very respectful.
Yeah.
But he's, like I said, he's looking at it from outside. So, and I think it shows in the stories.
Yeah. It was interesting to me. And of course, without even talking about the stories, I guess I'm going to go off on a tangent if that's okay. Mm-hmm. But, I had never read a bunch of his stories together. And when I had ever heard them, I just considered them one by one. And so I would think of them in terms of what they made me go on to reflect on. And when I got done with this book, especially after reading Hell is the Absence of God, I suddenly realized pretty much that he had that worldview, that he didn't believe in God, but that he was interested in these questions. And that made me think of Philip K. Dick, who, and it's really bad because I haven't read any of, well, I read one of his novels when I was in college and I took a science fiction class, which was The Man in the High Tower, but I didn't really have a, I had a very immature way of reading then. If I, you know, the story made me feel good, then I liked it or whatever. And so it was an extremely depressing book, as I recall it. So I kind of said no to Philip K. Dick. And then through short stories lately, via podcasts and other routes, I have come to really like his short stories. And my daughters have read Philip K. Dick. And one daughter in particular, Rose, loves him because of his writing and the questions he asks and the concepts he uses to examine them. Although she, like us with Ted Chiang, usually says, well, yes, he's completely wrong about this, this, and this, because he's not looking at the whole of the human experience or whatever. But she loves to read him because she finds it fascinating that he consistently brings up these questions. And I think that was when I suddenly went, I wonder if Ted Chiang is that, for me, that modern equivalent of Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, and that's interesting. Interesting way to look at that.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I can see the similarities. I can see what you're saying there. Yeah, and I haven't read a lot of Philip K. Dick. Just what we've done for the SFF audio podcast, a few short stories, and but I haven't read any novels of his. But Jesse says we're going to.
Well, I guess
think,
I'll have
I think Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is the one that he wants us to read.
And I've been told about that from two different points of view. Rose, who read it, and we wound up talking all the way through the grocery store and getting funny looks from people as we were arguing about aspects of religion and belief and everything. And then Hannah, who is very much into animals, and so she found the whole thing super depressing because there aren't really any animals around. And, you know, we won't get into the story. But both of them told me in depth about the story, so I'm going to be curious. I was figuring we probably need to read something by him for this podcast eventually.
Yeah, yeah, we sure should.
But first
should.
We need to read it.
Yes, make so. Sure, right.
But anyway, so I for me that was an epiphany. Reading all these stories together, I suddenly went, I always thought he was rather pro-religion for some reason with the stories I'd heard. And then reading them all together, I was like, oh no, he's not. He definitely
And that's, I think I've found that in... This is not the first time that I've felt that way about a writer. I recall reading Calculating God by Robert J. Sawyer, which is the one of the...
Yeah.
Well, it's probably the first book that I've read in which the aliens believed in God and were shocked that there were humans that didn't. And the first time I read that book, the book is really just kind of a presentation of all these arguments for and against God's existence. But when I first read that, I thought, oh, interesting. You know, I thought that he was a Christian, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I found out that he wasn't. I was like, oh, how interesting, you know. But that he was interested enough in these questions to write this book, and that I could read it and think, hey, you know, wow, that's really interesting to me. And it wasn't an atheistic book.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so I was surprised when I found out that Robert J. Sawyer was not a believer.
Yeah, I read that book, and I also was wondering that. And then I got to the end and went, oh, of course he isn't, because, mm-hmm. you know, that right. wasn't a Christian ending at all.
Yeah.
And we won't go into my dissatisfaction with that. Robert J. Sawyer and I have already exchanged words on SFF audio.
That's right.
Yeah. And he was distinctly displeased with me being mm-hmm. a Christian. So
yes, yes.
But mm-hmm. He does have the talent or the knack of coming up with fascinating questions, whether or not we agree with how he examines them.
Mm-hmm.
The questions he raises are usually pretty interesting. And that wasn't one I had never thought of either. Would aliens believe in God?
Yeah.
And it seems like I read a short story recently that talked about that very thing. And now it's going to drive me crazy. I'll have to see if I can think of it, because okay. they did. Mm-hmm. And if so, I'll put the link on the podcast or okay. blog on the blog for the podcast.
Great. Great.
But Ted Chiang is willing to have people believe in God
mm-hmm.
and have and many different worldviews.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and
follow it through to a logical conclusion, which I find that's part of his genius. Mm-hmm. He's not afraid of exploring the answer. It may not come out to ever be the answer I think of mm-hmm. because he's not got my worldview. But like Story of Your Life,
mm-hmm.
I thought that was actually the right way to end the story.
Yeah, sure.
It was very full of hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which yeah. is why we, I guess we need to probably start talking about the stories.
Right. But, well, let's talk about Tower of Babylon first.
That all right? So great.
Yes, it was excellent. So this is the first story in the book. Mm-hmm. And Tower of Babylon is about... It kind of takes this ancient worldview and assumes that it's correct. And then the people that live in this world want to build a tower to heaven. So they start building it, and it gets huge.
Yeah.
I mean, they build this tower, and people spend their entire lives just, you know, you get a wheelbarrow or something full of bricks or pulled by a horse or something, and you go around and around and around the tower all the way up into the sky and past the sky, and you're building
past
this thing
the
towards
moon
heaven
and the stars.
Yeah.
It was great. I loved that mm-hmm. imagery was so I was so surprised when he goes, then we were on the level of the sun. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Okay.
On the level of the sun. Yeah. And they said, yeah, the once they got past the sun, the daylight would come up on them instead of down on them, and it was an odd feeling. And but yeah, it was super interesting.
People would spend their lives living on the tower because it was so tall that, and they needed you know, food and things for everybody going up and down the tower with the supplies and mm-hmm. to do the work. So you'd have families living around all the different levels, and so when they grew plants, once they got past the sun, the plants all would go down over the edge to get their sunlight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, little details like that.
Yeah, it was really well done. It's told from the point of view of somebody who's a miner, isn't he?
Yeah, you're right. He's a miner. He's going hired. There to help him get into the vault of heaven.
Yeah,
with his mining stuff.
You can touch
stuff.
It. You yep. can touch heaven.
You can.
Or the vault that separates yeah. from heaven.
Hillalem is his name.
Yes.
Right. And boy, there was one part in that story where they this guy said, "Hey, come look off this edge," and I really felt that in my gut. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you did, but the one guy sat on the edge, and I mean, it's yes. so far down there, and the two fellows that were with him had to lay down and kind of peek over the edge. I would have been that one of those guys. I would have had to lay down and peek over the edge.
I would have been hugging the ziggurat and saying, "No, I don't think so."
Yeah.
But even, I mean, he thought of things like when a star was whizzing by and mm-hmm. hit the tower.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really that perfect, well, I guess it's much earlier than medieval worldview, but that's the kind of equivalent I think of for it, of, mm-hmm. you know, how concrete everything is.
Yeah, so they
so perfectly imagined.
Yeah, so he'd you know, they'd get to the level of the moon and they'd watch the moon pass by, mm-hmm. and they'd get to the level of the sun and you know, you didn't want to get too close to it, but it would pass by.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they got to the level of the stars were passing by. They were, you know, whizzing by, and one of them hit the tower and mm-hmm. cooled off. And then, you know, I can't remember how they got rid of it. They had to pry it loose or something. And
yeah, I think they had to use a pickaxe to get it out.
Yeah, and they said that the meteorites, they didn't call them meteorites, but whatever lands on the Earth, those are from stars.
Right.
You know, so, which was part of the ancient worldview there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and but after that, they get to the vault of heaven.
Yeah. And even in describing the way that they would prepare
Hello?
You still there?
Oh, there you are. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, you went away for a minute.
I just got this internet connection problem thing.
Mm, okay. Yeah, you sounded fine, and then you went away. You were just, we just said that they touched the vault of heaven.
Okay, yeah, and all the descriptions of what they did to prepare with the platforms of the bricks, with the passages, with thinking that, oh, there might be lots of water up there, because, and I know this from scripture studies, the medieval view was that the heavens were a giant bowl and they would just open slots to let the rains through the mm-hmm. water, the vault, from the vault. So they were worried that there might be all that water up there. So they have the sluices ready
mm-hmm.
and different fail safes in case it gets through. They, you know, okay, we'll give you this much time for anybody to get out. And then this door is coming down so we don't drown the earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we don't have a way to shut it. I mean, that was the science that he was using that was fascinating.
Yeah, it was fascinating. And then they, there was like a team of Egyptians that came in to start tapping out a brick or a big block. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about losing a tool over the edge? You know, that was an interesting aspect of it, too. If you lose a tool over the edge, then you've got to wait for another tool to be brought up to you. So you're kind of a burden to everybody because you're not doing any work.
Oh, well, that was their joke, I thought, where they mm-hmm. said they brought up a bunch so there were extras. But
yes, that's right. And that was what the guy said.
You know, but that would have really? Been the concept.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But I enjoyed that part of it too. But the whole, you know, all those aspects. But the thing as a whole, the story as a whole, you know, it started to make me think of, you know, religion as immature science. I remember I think I used those words for you mm-hmm. or to you, that, you know, religion has played a role in scientific understanding throughout, you know, throughout history, mm-hmm. but that, you know, religion as an immature science has that aspect of religion has fallen away as time has progressed, in my opinion anyways, but these people's beliefs were that, you know, they had certain expectations and, you know, these expectations were being met all the way up till, you know, the end.
Yeah. And the end is, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but mm-hmm. The overall effect of the story, I didn't think of the analogy that you did, but it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And the overall effect of the story on me just as a reader was to draw me into the point where I was really curious about what they were going to find.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And I did mm-hmm. not at all anticipate what happened.
Mm-hmm.
That was a complete surprise to me because I thought they would be surprised.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't think of how much I'm giving away, but mm-hmm. but he follows the architecture of that way of thinking logically through to its conclusion.
Yeah.
And yet at the end, I really loved the image that he had where he's talking about the fact that people tend to think of heaven and earth as being separate entities, separate like, you know, like there's a vault of heaven that we have to break through in a way.
Right.
And his image wound up being something that brings the two very close together. Now, he does use the word, thus would men know their place, but I see that's where we diverge. I could even go along with everything in the story pretty much up to that point, because as a Christian, there's the only good thing about you knowing your place is so that you can realistically see, clear things out of the way so that you can come to know and love God better.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to keep you down.
Right.
And the feeling I got from this, the way the story ended, was that, you know, people are supposed to know their place and stay where they should.
Yeah, and you're right. Yeah, that is kind of the feeling you get right at the very end there.
At the extreme end.
At the extreme end.
Final
yeah.
point.
Right.
Because up to that point, it's almost, they coexist. Heaven and earth coexist. And he's got a wonderful image for it, actually. And I was like, well, that is how Christians see it. But it's for our benefit.
Right.
Not for our detriment.
Exactly.
Does this make sense?
No, it makes total. It makes total sense. Yeah.
You know, so it brings up a fascinating way to think about how things, how we think about things, like you say. Do we look at things like that? Because we all have those things where somehow we're viewing things incorrectly according to our own preconceptions. And that's what this story is looking at.
Yeah. And that's a really good point too. Because
is it true?
That's one of the things, you know, these stories can be looked at as kind of a challenge to faith, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And when you live among folks, you know, that are a different religion or something, that's kind of a challenge. And the thing that's going on with this whole rapture thing right now,
oh, yeah.
You know, it can be a challenge, you know, because that's, you know, I know this is a digression, but it's like the media loves that rapture story because it makes Christians look foolish, in my opinion. And they love that, you know, they absolutely love that. And it makes, you know, explaining to people, well, not everybody believes this. In fact, I imagine that the number of people that believe it are really, it's going to be pretty small. You know,
well, especially for that particular date, there are a lot of Christians who believe in the concept of the rapture, where Jesus is coming, or not even Jesus is coming, but just a select group who are, I guess, worthy enough, good enough Christians get pulled up into the sky like Elijah?
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, in the chariot. And everybody else is left behind for it. My husband got really curious. He's like, what is this? As a lifelong Catholic, he's like, what?
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody else is left behind for a period of suffering and purification. And I was like, we've got that already. It's called purgatory. Don't have to do it here on earth. That's not the point.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing that that was kind of interesting to me out of that was when I went to look at what Catholics believe about something like a rapture type experience, he went to look at Wikipedia. I went to look at Catholic sources, and they all said the same thing. And I had never thought about this. We as a people believe in something that everybody else would define as a rapture. But they say there's the one event believers and the two event believers. Well, the people who think like that Harold Camping are the two event believers. Catholics, like most other Christians, are the one event believers, because the concept that Jesus will come again at the end of the world and have the reckoning, that's what a lot of people would call the one event of the rapture. It's just, we don't call it that because that rapture thing is a concept that was developed in the 50s and 60s, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So in a sense, it made me feel bad because I was, you know, making fun of this event because it was just, to me, ludicrous. And, but, you know, my brother's an evangelical, no, he's a non-denominational, sorry, Protestant. And, you know, he believes in the rapture. So then I started feeling bad for making fun of it, although I don't believe he believed in that event. But,
yeah, gotcha. Yeah.
But I was like, you know what? That's a further going away from what Catholics would believe of its truth.
Yeah.
But to the outside, it's all stupid.
Yeah, to the outside.
Like,
and that's the thing.
Tower
when
of Babylon
you,
thing.
Yeah, when you say things like, well, this guy's wrong because of this and this and this, and you realize that the arguments you're using against this person are arguments that are used – against you for
right
by atheists, you know, because, but you know, a lot of people don't realize that that's practically two different sets of belief.
Very different.
Yeah, they're very, very different. Like it. And so it's, you know, but then again, you know, you get the feeling, you know, like when the Da Vinci Code came out and all that talk about
all this stuff,
you know, it ends up being good and bad, because I've never had as many conversations with people about Catholicism as I had when the Da Vinci Code came out, because people would say, hey, right, I hear you guys have a problem with this. What's your problem with it? And now you have an opportunity to talk to somebody.
Yeah. Which is why you have to be informed enough to know what it is.
Right, exactly. And then the camping thing is kind of the same thing. But I feel like, you know, the whole sensationalism of it all. And now we got to get to wait till October 21st.
What's that? What's October 21st?
Camping came out yesterday and said,
I wasn't keeping up on my rapture news.
You know, in a nutshell, he said, yeah, in a nutshell, he said the event actually did happen, but it was a spiritual event that we can't discern from our physical plane or whatever.
I swear that's almost
exactly what he said. And he said, and now the next event is on October 21st.
No.
So not only, now we've got another 6 months of this, and the media is going to follow him and just laugh along, and the rest of us are just going to say, oh, I mean, it's tragic. It's a tragic thing.
Now I have to add him to my prayer list. I hope everybody's happy.
Yeah.
I'm writing it down now, people, right now. Harold Camping.
Right.
And I'm going to have to put Rapture Guy so I remember who he is later.
So how did I get onto that? I think I was saying that, that reading things that are challenging.
Because the artificial nature of this Tower of Babylon world.
Right. And yeah, he comes to the incorrect conclusion
that
right.
we have. And it also can look like the preconceptions that people have of us.
Exactly.
But I guess it's a good challenge to go, if nothing else out of this story, I loved the image that's used at the end for how do heaven and earth interact? And the whole idea of how do we look at heaven and earth and God and us? Do we have preconceptions that have been kind of laid down or that we've made up for ourselves that we need to chip away at?
Because that is exactly what I was trying to say. Was
the point of the prophets.
Exactly, yeah.
Is to make sure you don't. And he's, in a sense, doing that same service here. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic, yep. Well put.
With the wrong conclusion.
I was going the long way.
Sorry, Ted Chiang. Very wrong conclusion.
Yes, wrong conclusion, right. And that comes from, I think, again, you know, the abstractness, you know.
But there's
how many atheists have I talked to that believe, you know, that, you know, God is just cruel? And boy, this next story, hell is the absence of God. We'll talk more about that. But
Oh, my word.
Yeah, but I mean,
I guess
cruelty
that's
of it all.
You know what? Oh, my gosh, you're so right. Because that just made me realize, because the difference between this and hell is the absence of God, which are very similar in their abstract look, and story of your life, is that is not abstract. It allows for the human interaction and love and caring about other people that is very much a trademark of, or should be, of our relationship with God and our relationship with each other. No matter who we are, we're all human beings together. And that's why those stories resonate very differently.
Yeah.
And that one's more from the heart.
That's true. That's true.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. So let's talk about hell as the absence of God. Is there anything else you'd like to say about Tower of Babylon?
No, I think we've squeezed that one dry.
Okay.
Well,
and there's so much there. I mean, I urge people to read it. Yeah.
You could read it and reread it and probably get more each time. But this was his first story.
It was his first story. And just an interesting side note, in the Starship Sofa interview, Tony asked him, hey, why the 7-year gap? And he said, it was, you know, a really nice answer. He said that he won a Nebula Award for Tower of Babylon, the first story he ever wrote. And he said it actually had kind of a tough effect on him. It was, he said it was kind of a performance anxiety issue.
Oh, I can see that.
And he was like, you know, how could I top that? And anyway, he had to get over that before he could continue. So I thought that was very interesting. Nice, honest answer. Well,
I do want to say, for anybody listening who hasn't tried him, and we're saying things about, oh, he's got, you know, worldview that we don't agree with, and he's an atheist. But you know what? Hopefully through talking about these stories, we'll show, I think he is a really great guy from what I could tell from these stories. Yeah, he's so honest.
Yeah, really.
And that's all I ever would ask of from somebody who's seeking. He's thinking about all these things.
He is. He is thinking about. And you will use the word honest. And I think that is something that I've struggled with in my writing. You know, and I haven't written much fiction for a while, but, you know, I hope to get back to it sometime. But the my biggest problem was honesty. I would want to go somewhere in a story, and then I would pull back because, you know, I really didn't like where I was going there. But then I read people like Harlan Ellison, who I admire, and Ted Chiang, you know, and they go ahead and they go there.
And probably Philip K. Dick, if I ever read one of his novels. So too. But the
quality is summed up in that word honesty. They're willing to go in there and be honest about what they see. And, you know, to me, you know, there's a certain, I don't know if you'd call it fear, but it was a pulling back where, I don't really want to go there right now because of what it might say about myself.
Oh.
You know?
That's interesting. I haven't written fiction. I'm making a small attempt personally now, but I can see that because I suddenly was like, well, this story would need to do that. And I was like, but I like that person. I can't do that to them. And I was like, somebody's got to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that. But the thing too is that, and I say this just as somebody who is a convert who came from the same place that Ted Chiang and probably a lot of other people were, where I didn't have a background of faith at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back and forth with a lot of questions, and I had to be finally put in a place in my life where I was able to say, you know what? I've asked everyone but the one person, if he's even there and exists, who could answer it.
Mm-hmm.
Are you there, God? And as so to me, a lot of people are, you know, you might pray for somebody to convert or see the light or whatever, but I more think that what God would hope for, like I can speak for God, is that people are being honest.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're being honest, he's there everywhere, permeating everything, and he will make himself known to them. That's why people like Jeff Miller, who blogs at The Curt Jester, can be converted intellectually by the logic that he read,
mm-hmm.
versus me having a personal experience, versus you being brought back to the church by myriad different experiences.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's so much bigger than what we can imagine that for us to worry because someone's not following the path we think they should follow, as long as we're giving honest answers and letting them absorb that as best they can, what more can we ask? Because that's what's been done for us.
Yes.
If that makes sense. I'm not saying I don't think the Catholic Church has the fullness of truth, because I personally believe it does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if everybody were honest, this is where people are going to roll their eyes. But I think if everybody were completely honest with really evaluating things and put themselves out there, like you're talking about with doing with your characters and your writing, they would eventually probably come to a conclusion close to that,
mm-hmm.
if not to the church itself.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be Catholic.
Yeah, and we wouldn't be talking about this stuff. Yes,
that's right. That's
so,
right.
So anyway, sorry about that little diatribe there. But
all good. Okay. Hell is the absence of God. Now, this is a tough story. Again.
it's a very cynical story.
Yeah, and it's very well written, beautifully written.
Oh, yes.
I'm pretty sure it won an award, too, of some type.
It must have.
Neil Fiske is the main character. And in this world, angels are destructive in lots of different ways. Feel free to jump in here anytime.
More than anything, they're heedless to anything around them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just appear for whatever mysterious reason people don't know. And then they do whatever that is they're to do, but they pay no attention to whatever good or bad is coming of their presence.
Uh-huh. Right.
Doesn't that make, I mean, but they physically manifest.
Yes, they physically manifest, and all kinds of things happen. I mean, destruction, people die when they come.
Yeah.
People get cured, and all these things happen at once. You know, people, what was it called? The heavenly light or something? I can't remember exactly.
No,
if you get hit with the heavenly light, you actually fall in love with God.
Yeah, but your eyes disappear.
And your eyes disappear, but you've seen the heavenly light, so it's almost like you don't really need them anymore. You don't want them. All you can do is talk about God and how incredible the whole thing is.
Can I read this one paragraph that's early on that talks what happens? Mm-hmm. So it says, it was an unexceptional visitation, smaller in magnitude than most, but no different in kind, bringing blessings to some and disaster to others. In this instance, the angel was Nathaniel, making an appearance in a downtown shopping district. Four miracle cures were effected: the elimination of carcinomas in two individuals, the regeneration of the spinal cord in a paraplegic, and the restoration of sight to a recently blinded person. There were also two miracles that were not cures. A delivery van, whose driver had fainted at the sight of the angel, was halted before it could overrun a busy sidewalk. Another man was caught in a shaft of heaven's light when the angel departed, erasing his eyes, but ensuring his devotion. Neil's wife, Sarah Fisk, had been one of the eight casualties, which you really don't expect.
Right, right.
Because some glass, a window shatters.
Yeah.
And she bleeds to death from the cuts.
Right.
So.
Yeah, so it's
kind
of.
And then they can witness souls' ascensions to heaven or being pulled down to hell.
Yeah, and that's another really important aspect. They can see the people that are left behind, get to see, you know, when a person dies, the soul would go up or the soul would go down.
Right.
And so what you have here is a universe in which there is absolutely no doubt that God exists. But the mm-hmm. question now is God worth worshiping or not? Because Neil Fisk is upset, obviously, that his wife died.
Right.
And the story is about him. He wants to be with his wife. His motivation is, I really love my wife and I want to see her again. That's the most important thing to him.
Mm-hmm.
So how does one do that? Well, he can't commit suicide, because if he does that, he's going to go into hell.
Right.
And he's sure that his wife went to heaven. I guess he saw that. I don't recall that detail. But
it says that other people witnessed her, whoever was there witnessed her ascension to heaven.
Okay, so he knows that she went to heaven. So he's got to go to heaven. But the only way to get to heaven is if he loves God. And right now he doesn't love God because he killed his wife. So
also, he's one of those people who's kind of like what we were talking about, in that he was never... it says nothing in his upbringing or personality led him to pray to God.
Mm-hmm.
The trials he faced growing up were accidental or human, and so he relied on human resources to counter them. Even he's got a deformity. One leg, I think, is shorter than the other or something like that. And everybody who meets him assumes it was because of a visitation, and he keeps saying, no, I was just born that way.
Right, right.
So he is the ultimate human. Like, a non-believer in essence, but he's stuck in this world where God's manifest all the time via these angels, and the view of God that's manifest is so random.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and mean.
Yeah, uncaring.
Uncaring, I guess, yeah.
Nothing personal at all. It's just, because it says... the angel's parting words, which had boomed out across the entire visitation site, were the typical, behold the power of God. I mean, there's nothing there to make you care one way or the other than to go, we're like ants being squashed.
Yeah.
Or helped, but it's random. It's not deliberate.
Yeah. So I'm sitting here thinking, about, trying to connect. It is a difficult view.
And I didn't think about it till now, but it's the ultimate atheist view of how people like us look at this kind of thing.
Yeah. And that's my impression once I finished this story was, this is kind of the ultimate abstract view of religion. Because for someone who doesn't have the feeling or the, you know, any experience to say, hey, there's something, you know, more here. It's completely impersonal. And
especially since his story is set in opposition to Janice Riley.
Yes.
Who, because of a visitation, was not born with legs. She had flipper-like feet growing directly from her hip sockets.
Right, so the visitation happened when her mom was pregnant with her. Yeah.
And they had a visitation, or they had a, I guess after she was, they had an ultrasound and they were crying and going, what did we do to deserve this? And they had a vision of four deceased relatives. And so they were like, oh, this is a blessed child.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened to me is a gift. And I didn't think about it until this discussion, because I obviously didn't delve into it that deeply. But I'm like, oh, my gosh, that is just how somebody from the outside, when you go, well, you know, it was bad. But I learned so much through it that it was God brought good out of it anyway. And you're just like, oh, it burns, Ted. It burns. And worst thing is, I've been there. I understand exactly why he says that, because it's that internal knowledge that makes the difference, and that's not here.
Right.
This doesn't have that.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking this, we might have to declare a spoiler thing for this, because we really have to talk about the end of the story.
Okay. Go
Don't
for
you
it.
Think?
Yeah, absolutely we do. So, yes, spoiler time.
Yeah.
I'll put a link to the audio version of this story on the Good Story website. A Good Story is hard to find. blogspot.com.
Yes.
And I'm not sure where else you can find it, but Stories of Your Life and Others is the name of the book that it's in.
Yes, it's definitely worth buying or finding somehow. Get it from your library.
Yeah.
A lot of libraries have it because he's such a prestigious writer.
Right.
Because basically it's following Neil as he's trying to figure out how he can love God.
Right. That's all he's trying to do. He's trying to love God as he's just trying to do it because that's his only way.
I know I can do it.
Yeah. That's the only way that he can be with his wife. Yeah.
And so he starts belonging to different groups. There's a group of people who were left like him, bereft. So they have a once a week meeting. And then there's some other meeting he goes to. I wish I could remember it, that he finds more helpful. And I can't remember what kind of group that is. But that, I think, is the one that leads to him going to a spot where angels usually appear.
Yeah, what he's doing is he's a light chaser or something
that. Like a tornado spotter.
Right. I like it just like that. And they are always at the ready. So when one of these angels appears, they broadcast it over the CB and everybody goes racing towards it with the hope of ending up in a shaft of light.
Well, and there's one particular spot that tends to draw these angels to it. And so they all kind of like camp out there and just kind of hang out and drive around.
Yeah.
Don't they?
Yeah. They said, I think in the story it said, you know, the angel visitations are pretty random. You know, you could wait years and never see one. But if you go to a holy site, you may wait weeks or months.
Dang, this is just like, oh my gosh, now that I'm talking to you about it, how could I not have seen it? I guess because it's so wonderfully written, you're just sucked into it. But it's just like places like Fatima or Lourdes.
Right.
Places, holy sites.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow.
Thin places.
If anybody who is a lifelong Catholic or Christian and doesn't understand what the other side thinks, wants to know how it looks, don't you think this would be a good story to read?
It really would be. It really would be. Because,
it's a beautiful way to describe how stupid and random this all looks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's why he wrote it, but I think that's how it turned out.
Yes.
Because he does say in the, he has notes, which I love it when they do that.
Oh, me
end.
Too. Yep.
And I love it when they put it at the end.
Yeah.
About why he wrote it.
Yeah, and it's always nicer at the end, isn't it?
Yes,
you know,
it is.
Why do they throw that at the beginning? You know.
I know. But he was prompted by he saw a movie called The Prophecy, which is a supernatural thriller, and he was trying to think about angels, and then he started thinking about their terrifying power, and he was thinking, I love this, about Annie Dillard's quote, which says, if people had more belief, they'd wear crash helmets when attending church and lash themselves to the pews. And she's right, because that's what we don't see. Mm-hmm. There's an amazing power of God there. But so he was thinking about natural disasters because of that. And mm-hmm. then he was looking at the book of Job, and all these awful things happen to Job. And in the end, God rewards him. And he says, leaving aside the question of whether new children can compensate for the loss of his original ones, why does God restore Job's fortunes at all? Why the happy ending? One of the basic messages of the book is that virtue isn't always rewarded. Bad things happen to good people. Job ultimately accepts this, demonstrating virtue, and is subsequently rewarded. Doesn't this undercut the message? It seems to me that the book of Job lacks the courage of its convictions. If the author were really committed to the idea that virtue isn't always rewarded, shouldn't the book have ended with Job still bereft of everything? And I think this is a profound misunderstanding of the book of Job, which is difficult anyway. But it was a poem.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, not a poem, but it was a piece of fiction
mm-hmm.
that illustrates that point of you can't always understand anything. It doesn't mean that there's no purpose behind it.
Right. True.
When mm-hmm. God finally appears to Job, I'm assuming a lot of people have read this who are listening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a bet between basically Satan, who in this aspect is not an enemy, but more like a devil's advocate, a prosecutor, saying, I can prove that Job isn't as devoted to you as he seems. If everything's taken away, he won't believe in you anymore. And God goes, well, take your best shot. And so horrible things happen. His whole family's killed except for his wife, who, because she probably shows up and just nags the heck out of him for doing, because back in those days, people thought if you did something bad, you were punished by mm-hmm. God.
Yeah.
So if a natural disaster, if a tornado took out Joplin, Joplin is full of sinners. That's the theology of the book of Job.
Mm-hmm.
And his friends come to him presenting various things, and he's like, no, I love God, I'm devoted to God, but why, God, did you do this? And God finally shows up and says, where were you when I made the world? And it turns into this beautiful saying, actually, about the glories of creation and nature and the power that is there and all the things that we don't understand about even nature itself. And God's like, so when you can answer that question, because that's how different we are,
mm-hmm.
that's when you get your answer. And Job's like, good point. I accept that answer. And God goes, great, here's everything back. Not your old children, but, you know, more children and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no easy answer there, because there's no easy answer. Everybody has to solve it for themselves. But to take this outside view that devotion is meaningless.
Yeah.
Because the end of the story, Neil dies. Oh, wait, no. Neil is first hit by that heaven's light, and he's made blind. He loves God utterly.
Yeah, he's given that heaven's light, which makes him love God 100% completely. But this truck that he's driving, he's chasing after this angel. And then he gets the angel in his rearview mirror and is stunned by it because it's so amazing, and loses control of the vehicle, and it crashes, cuts his femoral artery in his leg. So he's mm-hmm. bleeding out, and as he's bleeding out, he gets this shaft of light. And now he totally is completely loves God, just like he hoped. That's exactly what he wanted. But then he dies and doesn't go to heaven. He goes to hell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it says, the light revealed to Neil all the reasons he should love God. He loved him with an utterness beyond what humans can experience for one another. To say it was unconditional was inadequate, because even the word unconditional required the concept of a condition, and such an idea was no longer comprehensible to him. Every phenomenon in the universe was nothing less than an explicit reason to love him. No circumstance could be an obstacle or even an irrelevancy, but only another reason to be grateful, a further inducement to love. Neil thought of the grief that had driven him to suicidal recklessness and the pain and terror that Sarah had experienced before she died, and still he loved God, not in spite of their suffering, but because of it. And so then he renounces all his anger. Mm-hmm. He's grateful for the pain because it brought him to that point.
Right.
Yep. And then he dies because he pleads and then he to dies. Death.
Yeah.
And the worst thing is he goes to hell.
He goes to hell, right.
Which right there is, did that logically work for you? Because to me, that was where he was being dishonest. Or seeing things in a way I couldn't see it.
Yeah, I'm really not certain. Yeah, because, I mean, the whole story was kind of set up around, hey, you know, what was it? What was his point? I don't know if he was being dishonest. It was more like, I mean, what was he saying there? That we know that God in this story is indifferent.
Yeah, it says when Neil finally...
it seems to me that there was a more than indifference there. It was like this was a decision by God to make a point, yeah. Because that he's cruel. Not only did he do that to Neil, but he made sure, and by he I mean God, made sure mm-hmm. that there were people there to witness exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Because there was two other people in the story that, you know, were intertwined with Neil. And, wondering, well, what's the point of these people? Well, they were there to witness exactly what happened to Neil and to tell everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So, what's the point there? But God is no longer impersonal there. He's actually made a decision, and the decision was that, I guess, hey, rules sometimes don't apply even. you think this is the way it is, but sometimes this is not the way it is.
I guess that's it's probably an indictment on Ted Chiang's feeling about the book of Job. Because he says, when he finally bled to death, he was truly worthy of salvation, and God sent him to hell anyway. And I'm like, but you know what?
That's exactly what the point is. I think you nailed it right there, because he said in the story notes that, why did God give him his stuff back, right?
Yeah.
And what he did in this story was he took his stuff away.
Yeah, he's capricious and he's cruel. And the book of Job is not an easy one.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the point was never that, I mean, because for one thing, God didn't do that stuff to him. He didn't interfere mm-hmm. when somebody else did it.
Yeah.
But he did allow it. And I mm-hmm. guess those were like the angels. But I don't know. I guess that's that lack of having the internal relationship. If you see what people who are married, the way they talk to each other sometimes or whatever, you might think there's an animosity behind it, when what's behind it is that they can talk in shorthand because they know and love each other so much
mm-hmm.
and understand each other so well. And I'm not trying to make excuses for the book of Job, because it doesn't really have a lot of answers other than we can't understand God. But it doesn't mean Job doesn't keep trying to understand God. And God comes, the only time God comes into the story is when Job asks him to,
mm-hmm.
and he comes to answer him, to right. say, I wish you could understand, but you don't. I'm sorry. I mean, it doesn't come off as I'm sorry. That's how I interpret it, I guess.
Yeah. You know, as we sit here and talk about this, I wonder, you know, you and I are sitting here assuming, you know, well, God would never do that, right? That doesn't make any sense, mm-hmm. you know, in this story anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But would God say to us, hey, you weren't here when I built the, you know, everything, you know, how can you predict what I'm going to do?
Well, of course, that's where you fall back on the Catholic teaching. God is truth, capital T, ultimate mm-hmm. truth, and
yeah.
truth is love. I mean, if you go with Catholic teaching, which I do, the only reason we exist and the universe exists is because God loves us and he wanted to share that love.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have to go into a whole lot of theology to justify that to somebody who doesn't already believe it. But so I won't.
Mm-hmm.
But you could say to someone, I didn't make this happen to you. And because of free will, I'm not going to interfere when a tornado hits Joplin.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's just, it looks cruel, mm-hmm. but it is how nature is. Yes. The fact that I get to live in a house with air conditioning is something I am benefiting from what people created. That's not the natural world that most animals live in.
Mm-hmm.
And we are animals with souls. So I don't know that God has something to do with that. If I'm in the air conditioning or out of it, that's not God's choosing. That's my choosing, or the choosing of the person who invented it and the person who sold it. And I mean, I don't know exactly where I'm going with this, except to say, to blame God for stuff like that, God would never send someone to hell. Because since I've just been reading several modern versions of Dante's Inferno,
mm-hmm.
and then kind of looking back at Dante's Inferno and what the church believes about hell, hell is not just the absence of God. It is the absence of God, but it has to be chosen by people, because Jesus came to save everyone,
mm-hmm.
to redeem everybody. And everyone, whether they live for 30 seconds or 100 years, that's the span they have to do the best they can in. When they die, even if they haven't made that choice up to then, when they die, they get to, that's their last gasp to choose, to go, oh my gosh, I was so blind, please save me.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're in purgatory. You may be there a long time getting all cleaned up, but you don't get kicked out ever. Hell is the active choice of I don't ever want to be with you. I have chosen, I would rather be here than to ever be in heaven.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, certainly does. Yep.
It's really well put in John Ciardi's introduction, his essay about Dante and how to read it, or, you know, all the different layers of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he makes that point more clearly, and I wish I had it here and I would read it to you, but it's, you have to actively choose hell.
Gotcha.
You know, even if you, even, you know, we could get to heaven or, okay, let's face it, I'm going to be in purgatory. I mean, I like to strive for more, but, you can be in purgatory and you could find yourself next to Hitler or Stalin or a horrible serial murderer or whatever, because God's going to always give you that last choice.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to pay for what you did, because your soul can't go in that twisted state into the presence of perfection. That's the light of heaven.
Yeah.
You know, but seeing the light of heaven doesn't make you blind. That's the other place the story's wrong.
Yeah.
We only get to see little chinks of it.
Yeah, I think Chang might have been saying there too. If you believe in kind of a automatic universe, then the fact that you believe in God is also something that's automatic. And for you to look in the heaven's light and have that give you the love of God, it's not really a choice at all.
Right. He's taken all free will out of
exactly.
That sort
There's
of thing.
No free will whatsoever. The whole thing's just a big clockwork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the best point. Yeah. And I guess that's the point he got out of Job. And to read Job, you know, that's the error that anybody can fall into. That's the problem with picking out little verses out of scripture to prove your point, or I read this book or that book out of the Bible and that proves this or that, which is Harold Camping's problem, actually, mm-hmm. of, you know, you can know the way. I couldn't believe it when I opened the Wall Street Journal and went, what is this ad? And it was all his little obscure verses about man can know things.
Mm-hmm.
That was his justification.
Yeah. Despite the one that says, you're not going to know.
Yeah, despite the one that when his disciples ask him, because he's been talking about the end of the world, when's it going to happen? And he says, I don't know that. Only the Father knows. I have no idea. So live your life now.
Mm-hmm.
Do not worry about that. I'm like, if I'm going to pick a random verse, that's one of them.
Yeah.
And that was what everybody was quoting. And that's why he was going, oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
But to take a piece of the Bible by itself is like saying, I would like to understand the universe or the world, and taking 5 little articles out of the Encyclopedia Britannica or a big science text, or, you know, you're making the same error that flat earth people make,
mm-hmm.
of saying you know, I the Bible says this, and so this is what I'm going with. They're not looking at the entirety of science. We have to look at the entirety of science as best we can to understand how the world works on that level. Why would you not pay the same respect to a theology? I wouldn't expect to go into Buddhism knowing three things that the Buddha said and think I get it and be able to write an indictment of it. Yeah. I would then say, you know, I think I need to read more and talk to some people and blah, blah, blah. And I understand this story is good. It's a fantastic story. But ultimately, this was the story where I was like, there is a serious deficit of overall knowledge in this person's worldview. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that's what I saw there.
Right, right. Yep, and I saw the same thing. Yeah. I think when I wrote you the email, was, I said, you know, we need to talk about where he's wrong in this story. And there are lots of ways.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because angels are God's messengers and they don't stomp around doing stuff. I mean, and they're created to serve God, and serving God is not stomping on us. But yeah, it's that overall, I guess, it's the cruel God who, it's the clockwork that's, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Purposeless. The whole thing seemed purposeless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, especially the thing that's especially egregious is probably the wrong word, but just wrong to any Christian is that he's in hell, but he loves God anyway. I'm sorry. That's just not how it works. Period.
Yeah.
You know, that's, and I realize he's saying that these people, I guess, meaning us, are so blind that we would believe despite any evidence to the contrary. But that's wrong. It's not hell.
Right. Yep.
No. And to give you free will, it's denying your free will to say that you can't choose to not want to go to heaven.
Yeah. And that's something that is extremely vital to me, is the whole concept of free will.
Yeah.
I mean, it's vital. So I know that there are Christian sects that believe
predestination.
Yeah, predestination. That's right. That's the word I was looking for. So,
yeah.
But I don't see how that's possible.
Well, from what I've read, and I haven't looked into it a lot, so I could be wrong, and people certainly can feel free to inform us further, but it's a misinterpretation, again, of certain texts of scripture, like, you know, the 1,440. Or like 144,000 of chosen will be with God kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's that picking and choosing of what they'll believe without taking the whole thing into context.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is the thing I love about the Catholic Church. They, you know, you go, oh, well, what about this and that? And they're like, oh, let us show you the 37 other places in scripture that weave in and out that all look at this and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It never takes stuff just on its own.
Right. But the entire thing falls apart without free will. I mean, everything does.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Let's start with Adam and Eve.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to tell you something that's dangerous, and I'm trusting you to do it. Oh, you did it. Well, here are the consequences of your actions, but you always have a chance. As long as you live, you still have a chance. You know,
right,
I'll never
right.
take that away from you. You choose what you want to do.
Yeah.
We are not automatons, and that's kind of that's also that what is it, 72 letters?
Yeah, 72 letters in here,
which we're not discussing. But that looks at creation, humanity, free will, and lack thereof,
right?
Evolution, all these various things, and attitudes to science. I mean, it's you know, I really wish that. Now, we know some people like Jesse from SFF Audio who are really open-minded and will look at other stories and not worry about who wrote them or what's the worldview. But I was reading a book called Death Panels, which is written by, I was telling you about it earlier, written by a Catholic. It's a dystopian novel. I really like it. But it's so looking at the effect on Christians of if the certain trends in society continued and were pushed to a dystopian level, what would happen there? And you feel like you couldn't get anybody who's not Christian to read it because they'd be just rolling their eyes the whole time. And I thought it was well written and all this stuff. It's no Ted Chiang, but, you know, let's face it, few of the people I read are. And I routinely read stuff and enjoy it by people who I don't agree with their worldview. It's thought-provoking and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You never see it go the other way.
Yeah, and that's really true.
And I just don't.
Not too often.
Yeah.
That is true. Yeah.
But, you know, like, I guess people read Eiffelheim. That's a very Christian book, Catholic book, as we discussed. But
well, another interesting thing, a fellow I know named Eric James Stone, who is LDS, wrote an extremely LDS story, just won a Nebula Award.
Really?
Yeah. It's called...
never heard of it.
That Leviathan Whom Thou Hast Made, or something. I hope I got that title right.
Oh, I think I've heard of that story. Okay. Yeah.
It's a very good story. Really, really excellent. It's about a Mormon guy who's... I can't remember if he's a bishop or a stake president. But he's got some parishioners, or members, they call them, in that are alien.
Okay.
And they're actually sun beings that live in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And
interesting.
It's very interesting. It's so it's Eric extremely Stone? Good. Eric James Stone.
Eric James Stone.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm gonna look for that.
That story's not on audio that I know of, but he's selling them for $1 on his site.
Oh, okay. I'll look.
And it's a current Hugo nominee as well. So.
Oh, cool. Well, you know, and I take that back because I said that, and then I thought of Orson Scott Card when you said LDS, and I went, oh, yeah, his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess...
I think that the problem is if it's presented as a religious book, you're not going to get many non-religious people to read it. But religious writers put religious things in their books all the time, and... you know, I think they're accepted.
Yeah, and I think I was thinking of this book, which I thought was, it was a good thriller dystopian book, I thought. And this, I read it because Jeff Miller at the Kurt Jester, I don't know if you read him, but he and I read each other's stuff, reviews and things on Goodreads and blogs and things. And I tend to go along with what he likes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a copy of this book, and it was... I thought really well done because it didn't rely on, you know, the exception miracle and all these various things. It was people doing things through their actions. And if God was there, it was, you know, people would pray about something and go, what am I going to do? I'm so stuck, like you or I might. Mm-hmm. And a coincidence might happen here and there, but it was nothing, you know, no angels were stomping around doing anything for anybody. And, I was thinking I would be interested to see what other people thought who weren't Christians reading it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also, and this is perhaps my own lack, be hesitant to offer it because it's the kind of thing that, you know, you start reading the premise and I could just hear the eyes rolling. It's the kind of thing I would tend to roll my eyes over even. So, I guess that's that kind of book specifically because it's talking about the effect on people of faith.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, actually pro-life. People, because there are a lot of people in it who aren't Christian, but who are fighting the same fight because everybody's being squeezed to death by, you know, whatever's happening with the government.
Sure, sure.
Anyway, that's way off target, I guess.
That's all right.
So the story of your life.
Story of your life, yes. And again, this is one of my favorite stories of all time.
Yeah, it's because it's more open.
Mm-hmm.
And personal.
And it is. You know, we talked about free will and things like that. I think it affirms free will. Even, you know, one of the difficulties about free will is, you know, God's supposed to know everything, right? God's outside of time. So he sees all of time. So he sees kind of what has happened, right? But at the same time, we're acting in that what has already happened. But what has already happened, God already knows. So how is there actually free will happening, you know?
Right.
Since God already knows what the end of my life is. Yeah.
And the choices you make.
Exactly. And I think that this story kind of touches on that, on how that might work.
Beautifully so.
Yeah. So.
It's told first person by a scientist who's telling a story to their child, her child.
Right. Yeah. And you quickly realize that something odd is going on, because what it does is it flips between her telling this story, and the same person who's telling the story is trying to communicate with these aliens who have made themselves known on the Earth, and they're you know, open and saying, okay, we want to communicate with you, but right now neither of us knows how to talk to each other. So here's this big screen. So she sets up her equipment and everything at this screen, and they talk to these aliens called heptapods. Mm-hmm. And they try to communicate with them, and their whole thing is they're trying to figure out how to, you know, how to understand each other.
Right.
And but the same lady who's kind of in charge of that is also telling her daughter, right, the story of her life. Yeah.
And it's what you realize in the first two or three paragraphs is she's talking in both past and future tense about the same events.
Right. Yeah.
So it's that that omniscient point of view of your father's about to ask me this question. It's the most important time in our lives. I want to pay attention. And then she says, right now, we've been married 2 years. Later, we'll do this. And there's no, we'll probably do this. It's later on, we'll do these things.
Mm-hmm.
Like way in the future.
Right.
Like way in the future. When this child's much older.
Exactly. Exactly.
And what you realize, I guess to keep it brief, since we have gone so long, and you probably have to go to work, but is that through talking to these aliens, finally figuring out how to communicate with them, and that was the science part where I finally had to go, I'm just going to skim this because it's really hurting my head,
mm-hmm.
Is they are able to, like God, as we've said, see the future.
Yep.
And because of how the way they think about things, and through her learning their language, and the language defines the way they think, she also learns how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole story is being told from somebody, the context of somebody who's learned that. And we already said spoilers, but big spoilers, because that's when you realize, and I was proud of myself because I realized it a little earlier than it was revealed, that everything she's talking about happens before she's even really gotten into a relationship with the person who's mm-hmm. going to be the father of the child. And you suddenly realize this person is the person who's going to be the father.
Right, right.
And yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, and the life-affirming part is that, hey, it's all worth it.
Well, especially since what you find out, and it's so jarring partway into the story, is that the daughter dies at the age of 25 in a skiing accident.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a skiing accident anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And she's telling the story, but she still hasn't even made the decision of the father saying, hey, let's go make a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And the life-affirming part is that knowing what's going to... I'm sorry, I didn't expect I'd get kind of moved by this.
Yeah.
But the life-affirming part is that knowing all that and knowing how much she'll love this child and what the child will mean as a person to her and everybody, she says, yes.
Right.
I want to go through all those things. All those fights I described with you as a teenager, mm-hmm. everything. It's worth it.
Yeah. All the good and all the bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's all one thing.
And this
thing,
yep. is the story where you go... Ted Chiang does understand more than you think about how God must, it's a little glimpse into God, I think,
mm-hmm.
into how you can reconcile the idea of free will and omniscience at the same time.
Right. Yeah. And that's how I felt about it too. And again, it was extremely moving,
mm-hmm.
very human, very scientific. I mean, it was, blew me away when I read it.
Yeah. Blew me away. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would recommend anybody, if they stuck through it past the spoilers, go ahead and read this story, and then, you know, be sure you read it to the end and think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
And unfortunately, we gave this story short shrift because we ran out of time, but it affirms everything that's wonderful about being human.
Yeah, when I originally just picked these three, I picked the other two because they were obviously religion.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one I picked not because it was religious, but because it was one of my favorite all-time stories. But
oh yeah.
I mean, you know, when you reread it and this stuff, you go, you know, and you look at things in a different light. I mean, yeah, it's really profound. I mean, and profoundly religious too.
Yeah.
It's and fascinating.
It's and I know he didn't intend this to be taken at that level, but since we're talking about God and omniscience, and if you look at this main character as a symbol of God, which as a Catholic, that's, you know, what we're talking about here, you know, it's just a glimpse of that tenderness and love that despite all the things that you and I will go through, God and creation, you're worth it. And each of us is what Catholics and most Christians believe. God created each of us specifically and put us exactly where we are for a reason.
Right.
Whether we know that reason or not, ever until after we die, doesn't matter. We're just here to, you know, live our lives the best we can and do the best we can. And that's really what this story exemplifies is that, oh, is that how you felt? That's really cool. You know, that little insight.
Yes. Yes.
So it kind of makes me less angry at Ted Chiang. But I got really angry at him when we were talking about the hell is the absence of God. Sorry, Ted. Didn't mean to make it personal. It's just me. So.
But yeah, fantastic group of stories. I mean, the whole book is great. Understand is another fantastic story. Reminds me of Algernon, Flowers for Algernon.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And then... gosh, division by zero, 72 letters. Yeah. And Exhalation, the one of them that's not in here, that story was absolutely amazing as well.
Yeah.
And, go try them out.
Yeah, definitely. And then, so let's see, next is, About a Boy, right?
Yes, that's right. About a Boy. Yep.
Yeah, which I'm always surprised at how many people haven't seen that. Mm-hmm. So.
And I haven't, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing it again. It's, I don't know if you could say it's the perfect movie, but it's just about as perfect as a movie can be on so many levels.
Oh, cool. Great. Looking forward to that.
And now people are going, wait, Hugh Grant, is this right? Are you talking about the right movie? I really
am.
Wait
a minute. Yeah, awesome. So. All right. And then the next book is Prince of Foxes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different from this, which is kind of why I mean, it was on my list, but that's, I went, let's do something really different. It's historical fiction.
Right. Yes, and I've got to get to work and pick the next two.
Yes.
So I will have that certainly by the next podcast. So, yep.
Excited.
Very nice. All right.
Yeah. Oh, and thank you to, I can't remember the name. Somebody reviewed us on iTunes.
Oh, nice.
Sorry I can't remember your name, but they said the nicest things and it really touched me because they're a Christian and a science fiction fan, not necessarily Catholic and a science fiction fan. So that's... always fun to think that the conversation is being enlarged.
Yes.
More points of view.
Right,
that
right.
Kind of thing.
I'm calling it up here. I've almost got it. And it is, Philip Hurd, I believe.
Oh,
yep.
Okay.
Right.
I see him on Goodreads too.
That's right. Yeah, he's out there on Goodreads. It's fantastic. Yeah. So thank you, Philip. That's very, very nice. Thank you.
Yes. Yep. Definitely.
All right. So we will see you in a couple of weeks, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Yep.
Thanks for hanging on. I know it was a long one. See you in a couple of weeks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mm-hmm.